Welcome back to the Megatherium Club podcast, everyone. This will be our last recording for the 2025 year. Wow, that flew by pretty fast. Hopefully you all had some good experiences. I know it has been a difficult year in the U.S. for science, facts, and overall kindness, amongst other things that seem like they should be the base of any good society. But here we are in this Idiocracy spinoff, it feels like.
Got there a little faster than the movie.
Oh, but my gosh. So yeah, it did take hundreds of years. One year down almost. God, I hope no more than three left to go. But Spencer, what are you excited about for this next year?
I'm excited for one, I guess, a second season of the current job I'm in. You know, the first year in a position is always difficult as you're learning the ropes. And so I'm kind of excited to see what happens and to see who comes to work at camp and meet some new people and make some new memories and to figure out what the future might hold after that. So, yeah, not too bad. What about you?
I have some projects I'm working on. I probably won't say too much until they come to fruition because I don't want to jinx myself. But my wife will also be finishing up a degree, so I'm excited to watch her do that and get her one and watch her get one step closer to her goals. Also, I don't want to jinx this either, so I won't give away too many details. But you and I are making steps towards a second podcast, and it'll be a little bit different from this one, but still obviously going to be scientific based and us sharing information with you all. So perhaps in one of the next episodes of this, we'll give some more information on that when to expect an episode. But for now, just stay tuned and I think it'll be a lot of fun.
Yeah, I agree. So,
yeah. Well, as far as this episode, we wanted to end the year with an episode that somehow related to the holiday season. Spencer, what animals first come to your head when someone says Christmas?
That's a great question. You know, generally I think of reindeer, polar bears, you know, things that live in the Arctic.
You took two of my four. I said also penguins, but that's the Antarctic. Yep. And then partridges, just because the two partridges in a tree.
And a pear tree.
In a pear tree. Yeah, that's the line from the song. So that is what we are going to talk about today, Christmas fauna. And, well, I guess I should clarify a little bit, Christmas Island fauna. There we go. So what is Christmas Island? This island is approximately 52 square miles. It's actually a territory of Australia in the Indian Ocean, south of Java and Sumatra, and about 840 nautical miles northwest of the closest part of Australia. So due to its location, it has a unique variety of fauna and flora. Why is it called Christmas Island, you might be asking? Well, it was discovered by an English sea captain of the East India Company named Captain William Miners, and it was discovered on Christmas Day in 1643. So nothing about Santa or reindeers or probably anything about, I guess, Jesus Christ in that sense either. That just happened to be the day some white guy on a ship named it. Not even the first white guy to see it. Oddly enough, that took place almost 30 years prior, but that guy didn't name it, so he lost out. Man, it could have been like Hanukkah Island or something, or anything else.
Yep.
April 32nd date, or even though it's like just anything. The island has had an interesting history that I won't go into great detail for the sake of time, but we'll glance over some highlights I found interesting. People didn't settle on the island until the 19th century, largely due to the discovery of phosphates in the form of guano being on the island. At one point, it was annexed by Britain, but it was invaded by the Japanese in World War II for those phosphate resources. Mm-hmm. The UK would then later transfer the sovereignty of the island to Australia in 1958 for a payment of $20 million. As of 2021, the island's population was 1,600. 9.92. So really not that big of a population. My high school had more people in it than this island does.
Same, same.
So, was there any cool facts that you found about this island, Spencer?
Yeah, a little bit. So the island is in atoll, meaning that it is kind of the top of a mountain that is kind of sticking out of the water. It's kind of sprung up during the mid-Miocene, I think it was, around 16 to 11 million years ago. So it's had quite a bit of time above the water to essentially grow and adapt in a way. But like a lot of atolls, especially around the equator, as volcanic activity underneath the earth pushes land masses upward, that seafloor begins to rise, and over time, before it, became an island, it was a massive coral reef. And so you get this basalt base layer to it. And then over top of this, you get this limestone buildup from this coral reef. And eventually, as the volcanic activity continues underneath the surface, it keeps pushing up and up until you pop out of the water. And there you are, an island, which will play into what I have to talk about later in the podcast. But I thought that was quite interesting. I like geology in that aspect. So, yeah, limestone covered basalt base. And that's pretty much all you need.
Nice. So basically, it's a small island, has some mountains, tropical climate, but what about its fauna? I wanted to talk about the island's crabs. Crabs make up a majority of the fauna world here, almost like mammals do elsewhere in the world. This is always a fun concept to me when you have these islands that mammals, for the most part, were not quite able to make the journey across the water to populate these islands. So they weren't able to cross the water to populate these islands prior to the assistance of man. And so you have unique animals that take over niches that mammals typically fill. Such as in New Zealand, their only mammal species that I'm aware of prior to human settling were bats and seals. So birds and insects took over a lot of niches that animals like rats and other small mammals would elsewhere, such as scavengers and ground foragers. This is why there are so many flightless birds in New Zealand and large insects even bigger than rodents found in other parts of the world. But here on Christmas Island, the crabs dominated. There are over 50 species on the island, many of which are endemic, and 30 are terrestrial, only returning to the ocean to lay eggs. The Christmas Island red crab, or Jacarcoidea natalis? That was not an easy one.
But it sounded great. It
thank you.
sounded great.
And this is one of the more iconic species and the one I wanted to focus on. And I'm sure the more I talk about this, you're probably going to be like, oh, I've seen this on social media or this or that. These crabs are about 4 to 5 inches wide, bright red. Shocker, I know, for this common name. But can be orange or even purple. Generally have claws that are the same size unless one was damaged or removed and the regenerating limb has not quite caught up yet. These are an example of a crab that is mostly terrestrial and spends most of its time in the forest, living in burrows, which it can use to escape the hot heat of the sun and the dry season and just safety. They only return to the ocean or coastline to breed, and this mass migration is what they have become famous for. But I will hold off on their migration just for a bit. These crabs are scavengers and opportunistic feeders, usually consuming leaves, fruits, flowers, seeds that have fallen to the forest floor, but will also feed on dead animals and even each other. They are also known for eating human trash and seen getting into trash cans. This migration occurs in October or November and is linked to phases of the moon, and they all migrate at the same time. They always spawn before dawn on a receding high tide during the last quarter of the moon and always seem to know when to leave the forest to make this date. They also align their trip over land with rainfall, specifically the first rainfall of the wet season. If the rain is early, they will take their time, check out the sites, forage along the way. But if the rain doesn't come until closer to this golden date, they will book it with no pit stops, just straight there. Don't ask to stop. If the rains are extra late, some crabs just won't migrate at all and they'll wait till the next month. As you can imagine, a migration of millions of crabs from the center of an island to the coast will have them crossing multiple roads and come into contact with humans as well as vehicles. Each year, thousands are crushed under the wheels of vehicles and can even cause some accidents because their exoskeletons can puncture through tires. So to keep people safe and ensure we don't wipe out these crabs after decades of them being ran over, park rangers will set up barricades to funnel them toward crab bridges and out of harm's way. And this bridge is just essentially like a climbing gym over a road that these crabs can climb up and over. You could as well, but I would probably advise against it. And the aluminum barricades are just something they can't climb over. Now, if they pile up against these barricades are only like a couple feet tall. They will obviously eventually pile over the top of them. And I saw pictures of just random crabs like lost from the horde because they've climbed over these barricades. But so it's not a flawless system, but it is cool how they're trying to help them. And I think over the years, people are also becoming more conscious and, I don't know if you will say, crab friendly and try to avoid them, but there's definitely a lot of desire to keep them around. The bigger males are usually the first to arrive at the ocean, soon followed by the much larger female population. Males will set up new burrows for the females to lay eggs in, and they must fight off other males from stealing their burrows. Once the mating takes place, the males will dip and leave the females behind to lay the eggs, guard the nest, and protect them while they develop for another 2 to 3 weeks. Females can produce up to 100,000 eggs and hold them in a brood pouch on their undersides. So they don't lay the eggs in these burrows, they kind of just hang out in these burrows for protection while their eggs are on the underside of them. Eventually, the females will begin to gather at the waterline and release their eggs over the course of 5 to 6 consecutive nights before heading back to join the males in the forest. The tide will carry the eggs out to sea, where the larval stages will develop over the next month. These little creatures are called megalope, and they appear prawn-like. After that, these immature stages will gather near the shore in tide pools until they are fully formed crabs. Well, very tiny, immature crabs compared to their parents, and then emerge onto land and begin their terrestrial life at approximately 5 millimeters across compared to the adults around 4 inches. These little guys and gal crabs will make a 9-day journey back to the motherland where they will try to stay hidden in the forest debris and rocky outcrops for the next 3 years before they are of a more mature size and have less to fear and start making this journey on their own. Oddly enough, not every mating season results in a new generation emerging from the ocean. Some years only produce a handful or none at all. But this inconsistency in successful reproduction is still enough to keep the island's population going. As far as predators go, a large majority of their natural enemies include fish, manta rays, and the popular whale shark. So obviously, these are targeting the larval stage, as none of these are really capable of reaching the adults that are in the middle of an island in the forest. I would stay on land too, though, if I knew the largest fish in the world was hunting my ass in the ocean. On land, they have virtually no natural predators, but coconut crabs have been observed feeding on these red crabs, and an introduced invasive species, the yellow crazy ant from Africa, has decimated or displaced around 10 to 15 million estimated crabs. It is believed. A weird fact that I found when doing some research is that when people first started settling the islands, there are few recorded mentions of these crabs, and I would imagine if millions of bright red crabs are doing this crazy parade a couple times a year, someone would write it down, tell a friend, tell the larger mainland government, but I guess it didn't happen, or they just ignored it. So there's a theory about why it might have happened, or why it might not have happened in such large numbers that we see today, and it's that the island used to have an endemic species of rat, Rattus McClearii, or McClear's rat, and that this rat might have kept the crab numbers in check, but this rat went extinct around 1903 after the black rat was introduced. I think the black rat transmitted some disease and probably was just a more successful in competition and drove this native rat out. So it was a native mammal. I don't think New Zealand had native rats prior to humans, but it seems like this island did have one species, just not enough to wipe out crab populations, just keep them under check. One might think this red crab would be an abundant source of food for humans and are shocked that we haven't wiped them out ourselves yet for this exact reason. But as humans are, we definitely did try to eat them at some point to the point. But fortunately for the crabs, they do not have a lot of meat on them and consist largely of water. So they really aren't worth it for humans to consume. But that is the Christmas Island red crab. My honorable mention was just another crab, or the coconut, yeah. The coconut crab, or the also known as the robber crab, Burgess latro. Mm-hmm. And I'll just briefly state some fun facts I saw about that, since I already mentioned it a little bit.
Yeah,
but it's the largest terrestrial arthropod in the world, weighing up to 9 pounds and is over 3 feet wide. So
just insane.
Absolutely huge compared to these red crabs. They get their coconut crab name from the young crabs carrying around empty coconut shells to use as protection, but they later drop these as the adults develop a hard abdomen and simply don't need that additional protection. Their robber crab common name comes from their affinity for stealing or running off with random objects it finds. Shiny pots, silverware, scavenged food items, and more. Here in the U.S., if we are out backpacking or camping, we have to hang bags from trees to keep wildlife away, usually in the form of bears or another mammal. But on Christmas Island and similar places throughout the Indian and Pacific Ocean where these are found, it is necessary to hang bags to keep the crabs out of stuff. But they are good at climbing trees, though, so you better be smart on how you hang the bag or which branch you hang it from, because these absolute units may still find a way to get to your stuff. But that's some crabs.
There was like an old internet rumor that coconut crabs, if you were caught taking a nap at the base of a tree, that coconut crabs would come up and just start eating you while you were alive.
Probably.
It's not true from everything that I've ever found out about it, but I remember seeing pictures of coconut crabs and being like, these giant crabs eat people in the tropics, so be careful. It's like, oh my God.
Are you saying you don't think someone's ever fallen asleep in these jungles and had a crab just crawl up onto them and start like biting them? You don't think ever happened?
Definitely happened. Yeah. But but the way that the internet made it seem is like these things hunt you.
Oh, I think they're just like, this is an edible thing. And then they try. It's not like they're like, yeah, dead or alive, I'm going to try to get some nutrients right now. And then
yeah.
I'm sure you can fight them off or run away, but
yeah, I think run away would probably be the better option.
Yeah, you'd punch it and break your hand or something.
Yep Beautiful. But
crabs,
yeah, just I can't imagine being one of the 1200 people and knowing that you are vastly outnumbered by crabs.
Yeah, there's like 40 million crabs on this island. The number might be a bit higher, but it was
they could easily rise up against you and you'd be powerless to stop it. So but incredible. So well, I'll talk a little bit about what I was looking at. So kind of going back to the formation of the island, you have this limestone cap over this, you know, basalt layer, and limestone is very easily dissolved by water. And when you are an island that's existed around for, you know, some millions of years, and you're especially in the fact that you're in a tropical area, you get lots of rainfall, and this water falls down onto the island, and over time it starts to eat away at the limestone. and develop cave systems. And as the ocean levels rise and fall over and over again, fresh water mixing with salt water only speeds up that process. And so Christmas Island is not just a rock face. It's dynamic both above and below the crust of this island. And so you have different layers of island or of caves throughout the island. You have kind of towards the top of the island, more dry caves that drain out really well, down into lower caves where you might have pools of fresh water, and even down to the sea level where you'll have caves that mix fresh water and salt water, forming layers. And then you might even have cave systems that are completely underwater now, submerged entirely. Each of these cave systems create a really unique environment for animals of all types to live in. And so that's what I want to kind of talk about. And some of the upper caves, the more dry caves, or some of the ones that might have a few pools in them, you'll find an extremely unique arachnid. I was reading this paper and it kept calling them an Australian arachnid. It technically is
a little far away from Australia.
Yeah, by like government standards, it's an Australian thing,
I guess. Yeah,
but it's not. And so it's, I don't know. I thought it was kind of funny and kind of threw me for a loop. But either way, you have one of the rarest arachnids, not only in Australia, I guess, but in the world. The only other place you can find some of these arachnids are in Mexico, in Central America, where you also have tons and tons of limestone caves. And it is a blind scorpion. The species name is like Leocelles polysorum. There's only one species of scorpion, and it is this blind scorpion. It's a troglobite, which is one of the best words I think in existence. And a troglobite is something that spends its entire life inside of a cave and really can't survive out of caves. So when a species becomes adapted to living in a cave, well, caves lack something that we all kind of take for granted, and that is just light. And so anything that relies on light, say our eyes, become completely useless. So over time, why would a species maintain the energy to develop eyes when you don't use your eyes? And so you have this thing known as regressive evolution, where unnecessary traits slowly disappear over time. At the same time, other non-visual senses become more adapted to living within these cave systems. So this scorpion has since lost its eyes, completely blind, but it has elongated limbs that allow it to essentially feel more of an area within its kind of body plan. Sensitive hairs that kind of cover the entire body. Both of these things in conjunction work together to detect vibrations through the stone. And like all scorpions, they are predators. And within these cave systems, they are apex predators. And so they'll be feeding on things like the Christmas Island cockroach, which is also a troglobitic species that lives within these caves that are feeding on something that I'll talk about a little bit later. And what's interesting is that when scientists discovered these things in the 1980s, when we really started to explore these caves, scientifically at least, it's a sign that these caves have been around for a very, very long time, but also the fact that you have an apex predator that is adapted completely living in these caves mean that these cave systems are very, very stable, because predators don't exist in an environment where they're adapted to unless everything else below them within the food chain is also stable. Scientists really started taking a look and saying, oh, wow, this is really important place to protect. And so they've kind of since started to really protect these things. And I'll get into a little bit about why they needed protecting a little bit later. But you hinted at it when you talked about the Japanese invading Christmas Island. Mm. So Above the cave, you have something clinging to the top of the cave. And you might think something above a cave clinging to the top might be bats. And in most cases, you are correct, especially when it comes to something like an isolated island out in the middle of the ocean, because bats can fly, so they can fly to the island. But in this case, you don't have bats. You have the Christmas Island glossy swiftlet, which is a small bird. And these birds, they nest in the tops of these caves. So they're called troglozines, I think is how you say it, where they live in caves, but they come out of the caves during the daytime in order to get the food that they need to survive. Every night, they come back into the caves, they live in these nests, and constantly they are pooping.
Sounds like
And
me.
they are, yeah. Yep, it's true. And like other things that poop within caves, these swiftlets are creating what's called guano. Most of us assume bats only produce guano, but in that case, no, swifts also produce this guano. And guano is high in phosphorus, just like you were talking about. So that means humans really like to get it because phosphorus is used in explosives, which is why the Japanese were going after it, in order to get more explosives for World War II. But guano within cave systems is not just a big pile of poop. It is essentially the life force that maintains any cave ecosystem that has an opening. The birds will go out and they'll eat insects and they'll poop out this these in you know the what is left and remained of the insects and whatever gut biome they might have. And then other animals like invertebrates, cockroaches, will use the guano to essentially survive, and they'll create entire tunnels and things within the guano to live in and to breed in and to survive in. So guano is not just a big pile of poop. It is literally where these invertebrates live. And because these invertebrates are here, that means that there are predators like the blind cave scorpions. So the swiftlets, they fly into these caves and they move around. But like all caves, it's very, very dark. And they will use echolocation to move around. Just like bats, they'll produce rapid clicking noises, listening for bounces off the walls in order to determine where they are at spatially within the cave. This is not a trait that is very common in any birds, so it's very rare, and these swiftlets have kind of nailed it. But these swiftlets, they, like I said, they nest, so they don't cling to the top of the cave like upside down like bats, but they do have something that does cling, and that is their nest. So they'll take, fibers, plant matter, whatever they can find out and about, they'll bring them into the cave and they'll use their saliva in order to cling this plant matter to the top of the caves, creating these nests, and that's where they'll live. When these scientists were beginning to explore these things in the 1980s and 1990s, they discovered that there were these really long wooden poles that were inside the caves, like leaning up against the side of the caves, which means that there's evidence of humans going into these caves with tools, and they were doing something. And what that something was is something that is not as much practiced anymore, but at one point it was pretty prevalent. And from the article that I did read, it happened on Christmas Island, but it wasn't as widespread or popular as it was in some of the other islands or some of the other, I guess, mainland caves throughout Southeast Asia. But what they were doing with these long sticks is they would go into the cave and knock down these nests, collect the birds' nests, and then make something called bird nest soup. And
Scrambled
I guess
eggs.
it's no. They would make a soup out of the bird's nest.
Ew. Well, I guess
Yeah.
it's plant matter and
It's plant
spit.
matter with spit. And so,
And
there you go.
nice.
And they would kind of heat it up and mush it into the soup and eat it. And I guess in places like China, it's like, a delicacy and has a lot of cultural significance. And that practice was practiced on Christmas Island at some point. But what this means is that humans are going into these caves and they're trampling down on the guano that has built up. And when guano is trampled down, it becomes kind of hardened and much less useful for the invertebrates that are living within the caves. Now, fortunate, it wasn't a super practiced, so the guano piles weren't as affected, but you still had lots of people coming into the caves, especially in the 19th century, like you said, the Japanese, that were harvesting this guano. So, there was already some damage there, but it is what it is. So, yeah, I thought that was quite interesting, the fact that these swifts make these nests inside these caves, and they're the ones that are using echolocation to move around. You'd think it'd be bats, but it's not. It's a bird.
Yeah, I'm glad you... I'm glad I didn't claim that there were bats, because I saw guano when I was doing my research, just assumed it was bats. Continue on down that path. I was like, man, it's guano. But yep. I'm glad I didn't say bats, because it's not.
I thought it was bats, too, at first as well, because the article I read was mostly highlighting this blind scorpion, because it was kind of an article that was talking about, like, hey, we found a new species of scorpion that's blind, super rare thing to find. They talked about guano as kind of the basis for, you know, the energy output for the entire cave. And I was like, oh yeah, bats, you know, and there are bats on the island. There are flying foxes.
Yeah.
But flying foxes don't nest within caves. A lot of them are within trees and stuff like that. So they're not cave dwellers, but these swifts are and produce the guano, right?
I also forget bird droppings can be called guano.
Yeah, I mean, it's so associated with bats that it's...
But it must be, like only when it's in caves? Because you don't just hear say that, like, about, oh, there's guano on my car because of all the damn robins or something.
Right. I don't know if that's necessarily, like, you know, there's a different variations or different definitions outside the scientific world, within the scientific world. And as far as I know, guano, I think what makes guano is the fact that it's high in essentially in like remains of insect skeletons. Mm. So I think it's more about the composition than it is maybe the location.
Gotcha.
But the location, because what these things are, a lot of them are bats, right? And so bats tend to live in caves, where you then get a collection of bat droppings, which is called guano. So I think there's like some correlations there, and I'm not quite sure how it all fits together, but
gotcha. I did look up bird nest soup, and it looks as disgusting as I imagined.
yep.
But they claim it's just a delicacy made from hardened saliva, and then it's this gelatinous soup, and like, what the, ew. It just looks like goops of jelly that are see-through and like broth. I don't know how to make it.
I didn't really want to care to look that up.
It looks like they just add like sugar to it. I'm sure hot water and whatnot, but I guess it's high in protein and has a unique texture. I imagine that.
Yeah. Yep. I saw one picture and thought, no, not happening. No.
Usually double boiled into a soup. I imagine it would take a bit of heat to make that even remotely edible.
Mm. Yeah. But who knows? Maybe it tastes really good and we're just ignorant and lame.
I guess I can't eat it as a vegan.
Oh yeah, you can't eat it because it's not vegan.
Yeah, I guess you'll have to try it for me.
if I ever get a chance, I'll give it one spoonful and I'll let you know how it goes.
Hell yeah.
But I'll have to guarantee that they didn't take a live swift nest.
Do they farm these? I feel like I've seen this before, and they actually farm it.
I don't know. I don't know exactly know how you'd farm it. Like, you'd just hope that the swift abandons the net or something, or the nest or something.
Oh yeah, yeah. So you make artificial habitats, swiftlet houses that mimic these caves, and then you just harvest the nests. So yeah, I'm it's all coming back to me. I feel like I've watched a show about this, about these random farms for swiftlets. but it's just for their nest, so people can make this, I guess, delicacy. Seems like a very niche thing.
That is, yeah, super niche. Okay, well, neat. If I ever find an abandoned swift nest, I'll have to knock it down and make some soup out of it.
There you go.
So, cool. And I know I've talked a little bit about a couple of different species, but there was one other, like, little tiny thing that I wanted to mention.
Yeah.
Continuing with the cave systems here. So, like I said, as you kind of move closer and closer to the ocean, you obviously get caves that begin to mix with salt water. There are these flooded caves, and I think I'm saying this right, and anchialine systems, where the caves are connected directly to the ocean. So they're affected by the tides and different types of water meet, where you have a fresh water layer on top, and then you have this salty sea water layer on bottom. And you can have in between this layer what's called a holocline layer, where the two are starting to mix but don't truly, you know, allow them to mix entirely. There are crustaceans that essentially have existed within these cave systems since their formation millions of years ago. And these little tiny shrimpy crustaceans have existed unchanged since the time of the dinosaurs. I didn't dive too deep into the different species of them because there was quite a few, but there were some that were thought to have been extinct, but they were discovered within these cave systems on Christmas Island. And I thought that was pretty interesting, finding living fossils within Christmas Island, a nice little present on top.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I thought that was kind of cool to kind of wrap it up.
Gifts. Get it? Christmas gifts get wrapped.
There you go. So, yeah. Christmas Island, a unique place owned by Australia for some reason. I still don't quite. I mean, it's all colonization, right? The British claimed it as their own and then gave it to the Australians. I don't know. I don't know who it should really belong to. Maybe it should just belong to themselves. But at least, you know, hopefully Australia can continue some of these conservation efforts for the crabs and for these ecosystems.
Yeah.
But there's a lot to discover. I mean, most of these cave systems we can't access. We don't have the tools or the technology to quite do it yet. So there's still things to be discovered there.
Nice.
And like a lot of places, we have to continue to protect it if we want to be able to actually discover those things before they, you know, go away. So,
yeah. And then I guess over your Christmas holiday, just, you know, you see a picture of a reindeer, you see a picture of a polar bear, but now you can also think about red crab migrations and birds, blind scorpions, nest soup and scorpions and new animals for you to correlate with Christmas.
I would like a nice little Christmas scene with all these animals included on them. Sweet.
Yeah,
awesome. All righty. Well, Merry Christmas to you, Sean, and Merry Christmas to all of you who are listening. Happy holidays if Christmas isn't your thing. And obviously a Happy New Year, and we'll see you in 2026.
You too.
All right. Love you. How, how.
How, how.